Welcome to the Science Update Podcast. I'm Bob Hirshon, and this is the podcast for October 27th, 2006. This week, Justin Warner tells us about the surprisingly masculine face of compulsive shopping, and Chelsea Wald reports on some new results about the striking health benefits of smoking bans. But first, humans have caused the extinction of countless species, but we aren't the only reason for extinctions. In fact, most ancient species went extinct for reasons we still don't fully understand. Chelsea has one explanation that could account for some of them.
Not all extinctions are due to comet strikes or overhunting. In fact, new research shows that long-term cycles in the Earth's orbit and the tilt of its axis may be responsible for a regular rhythm of species extinction and creation. Paleontologist Jan van Dam of Utrecht University in the Netherlands found the connection by charting turnover in the fossil record of rodent species.
We found periods of 2.5 million years and another period of about 1 million years. And these are exactly the same frequencies which are known from astronomical calculations, which describe variations in the orbit of the Earth and in the tilting of the Earth. So that made us think that there could be a connection.
Van Dam says these cycles in Earth's orbit and tilt may have caused periods of global cooling, which in turn could have caused some mammals to perish while others flourished.
Thanks, Chelsea. For over 1,000 years, priestesses at the Oracle of Delphi in central Greece drank in vapors from the earth, went into a trance, and then made prophecies for eager pilgrims. In the 1990s, scientists discovered that two geological faults intersect deep beneath the temple. Gases could well have issued up from these cracks into the chamber. Now, a new study in the journal Geology proposes that the gases were carbon dioxide and methane, which could have made the priestesses feel lightheaded and possibly prophetic. In other geology news, researchers from the University of Kentucky report that carbon dioxide, a contributor to global warming, could be stored safely in underground shale deposits. Scrubbers installed in coal-burning plants and factories can capture the gas. Shale deposits could provide a place to keep it. Next, Justin Warner brings us the latest in the farmed salmon versus wild salmon debate.
Farming fish may seem like a good alternative to depleting wild fish populations, but unfortunately it's not that simple. Recently, Martin Krakosik of the University of Alberta in Canada confirmed suspicions that salmon farms can indirectly kill young wild salmon within a 35-mile radius. He says they do it by spreading sea lice, a surface parasite that's relatively harmless to adult salmon, but deadly to juveniles.
These fish are only about an inch long. They weigh about 0.5 grams. They don't have any protective scales, and all it takes is one or two lice to kill them.
That's not a big problem in the wild, because juveniles usually have no contact with adults for the first few months of life. But lately, more and more salmon farms have cropped up along the juveniles' migration routes. Depending on the time of year, Krakosik found that up to 95% of migrating juveniles can die from sea lice infections they picked up from the farms. He says this must be contributing to the overall declines in wild salmon populations.
Salmon naturally have high fluctuations in their returns. You know, some years are huge and some years you hardly get any back. Now, if you impose, 50%, 80%, 90% mortality because of a new parasite, year after year after year, it doesn't look good for these fish.
Krakosik says that since other fish species also begin their lives separate from adult populations, it's possible that they too could be vulnerable to infections from fish farms.
That's the real irony here. You know, there's a common belief that by eating farmed fish, we're doing wild fish a favor by relieving fishing pressure. But it actually looks like as we're supporting the aquaculture industry and the industry continues to grow, it's having a net negative impact on the wild fish. So you're actually not doing the wild fish a favor by buying farmed fish.
He says the first steps to improving the situation would be to move or seal off the fish farms, an unfortunately expensive and labor-intensive proposition.
Thanks, Justin. Despite popular stereotypes, men are about as likely as women to be compulsive shoppers. This according to a new study by psychiatrist Lauren Curran and his colleagues at the Stanford University School of Medicine. The researchers screened over 2,500 randomly selected adults for compulsive shopping patterns, like irresistible urges to buy things they never use.
One man had 50 cameras that he never took a picture with, or another man had 2,000 wrenches. Another woman had a garage full and a house full of craft materials that she planned to use in crafts, but in fact never did use in crafts.
Corinne says that until now, all the information on gender came from treatment studies, which actively recruited volunteers who thought they had a shopping problem. 80 to 90% of these volunteers were women.
And so it was thought that men weren't particularly affected by this problem. But now it looks like men are about equally affected and just don't come for help, which is what we see also in men with major depression.
Overall, Crayon's team found that 5.8% of the population has symptoms consistent with compulsive buying. Technically, compulsive shopping currently falls under the heading of miscellaneous impulse control disorders, but between the explosive growth of internet shopping and the ever-broadening selection of consumer goods, Corinne says the problem may soon warrant its own clinical definition. And while unchecked compulsive shopping can wreck credit ratings, family finances, and even marriages, Corinne says treatment is effective. He hopes the findings will encourage more people, especially men, to seek help. Well, no doubt you're aware that smoking bans in restaurants and bars have been popping up all over the world. Chelsea has the latest research on how these bans help employees.
One of the arguments for banning smoking in bars is that it protects bar workers. Now, new research from Ninewells Hospital and Medical School in Scotland shows just how dramatic a difference it makes. Pulmonologist Brian Lipworth and his colleagues found that within just 2 months of a smoking ban, the percentage of non-smoking bar workers with symptoms such as coughing, shortness of breath, red eyes, and runny nose dropped from nearly 80% to below 50%. Volunteers also improved on lung and blood tests.
I would say the results are unequivocal. And if you can see these changes that early after a month or 2 months, then that has to be important for people who are being exposed to secondhand smoke. Not just the bar workers, but they're the ones who are exposed the longest. But, you know, people who are sitting in the bar for maybe, you know, a couple of hours in an evening, you know, having a beer.
He says, however, that he doesn't expect people to improve much after the two-month period, since by then the short-term effects of the secondhand smoke will have worn off almost completely. Not surprisingly, though, bar workers with asthma improved the most, and he plans to follow up with them. The study didn't look at long-term effects of secondhand smoke, like cancer.
Thanks again, Chelsea. Well, that's all for this week. Next time, we'll reveal the dangers of being a male in love, especially a male prairie dog, and talk about the possible effects of caffeine on kids. In the meantime, please visit our website at www.scienceupdate.com to ask your science questions and give your feedback. If we answer your questions on the podcast, you'll win a Science Update mug. Thanks for listening. I'm Bob Hirshon for AAAS, the Science Society.